not monks, trapas, whether they are genyes or gitsos or gelungs or geshes or lama gyupas or kenpos. I hope we're getting to become familiar with these terms, nearly always live in gompas or monasteries. A gompa literally means a place for meditation. Gom. Gom is meditation. So a gompa is a place for meditation. And practically all monks live in and belong to monasteries. And usually they are formally enrolled. You have to have your name registered at a certain monastery, and you belong to, you officially belong to, that monastery. And that means that you cannot be absent without permission. Now, there are proctors who go around every night making sure that every monk is in his cell. And they go around with great iron staves, and they bang them on the ground as they go along, and make a great jangling and jingling noise just to let you know that they're coming. And you have to be there in your cell. I don't know what the time is. I think it's 10 or 11 o'clock at night, something like that. But you have to be in. You mustn't be outside the monastery gate after that hour. Otherwise, you're hauled up in front of the kenpo, in front of the abbot, next morning. And monks are allowed to visit their old home very rarely. I think it's a matter of once a year or once every two or three years. They're allowed to go home and see the old folks and their brothers and sisters, but not more often than that, for obvious reasons. Now, you might be wondering, well, how do the monks spend, or how do they pass their time? First of all, there are lots of services, as we would call them. In every monastery, whether large or small, every day, there are three or four, sometimes a year five, sort of liturgical services, where there's lots of chanting, lots of blowing of horns and banging of drums and clashing of cymbals, and it's all very, very impressive and very powerful and very effect-producing. And they engage in this, they participate in this, as I say, at least three times a day, sometimes four, sometimes five. And you can imagine the tremendous effect of all this. If three and four and five times a day you are sitting and for half an hour, 45 minutes or 1 hour, sometimes 2 hours together, you are chanting. And you're not chanting something meaningless, not chanting something nonsensical or valueless. You're chanting the words of the scriptures, you're chanting prayers, you're chanting invocation to the lamas, praises of the Buddha, you're chanting things like the Diamond Sutra, the Heart Sutra, you're chanting summaries of the doctrine, you're chanting meditation texts, and all the while, as I say, there's the booming of these great trumpets and the rattling of the tambourines, and the higher sound of the clarinets at certain points, certain intervals, where certain deities and Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are invoked and asked to be spiritually present. And this is very, very impressive. And if you join to this the sound of the monks' voices when they chant, and don't forget Tibetans have got very deep bass voices. I think they've got the deepest and bassest voices, bassest with two S's, of course, in the world. They're rather like Russian basses. It's extraordinary, the low notes which they can sound. And I may say just in passing that the Dalai Lama especially is a case in point. And I remember that many years ago, well, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, I was present with him in Bombay when he happened to visit the Japanese Buddhist temple at Worli in Bombay. And for some reason or other, I don't know what had happened, he was quite on his own. Usually there's a swarm of monks and a swarm of officials around him, but on this occasion he seemed to have been able to shake them all off, and he got away on his own in some fashion. So there he was, surrounded by these people in the Japanese Buddhist temple, and with myself also. We were together in the shrine, and everybody else was outside, and he started chanting. And believe it or not, but his voice filled the whole place. And it was the deepest voice, I think, even for a Tibetan, that I have ever heard. And he was quite young at that time. He was in his middle 20s. But it was so deep. And when he chanted the mantras especially, the whole place sort of trembled. And people felt, they told me afterwards, and I certainly felt, saw little shivers going up and down the spine. It was a quite extraordinary sensation. So imagine when there's not just one person doing, but when you get a great hall, semi-lit, half in the darkness with these great images at one end and tankas on the walls, and you get the sound of the musical instruments and you get the incense burning and the flicker of lamps, and you get hundreds, in some cases thousands of voices all chanting. These very deep bass voices, with just a few boys' voices in between, all chanting. Then I'm told, and I've heard myself at least a few hundred monks chanting together, it's like a great wave, a great rolling wave of sound, which goes from the back right up to the front of the congregation. And people say, there is nothing like this on earth, in a sense, so far as sound is concerned, for sheer volume and depth and intensity. So imagine if you, three and four, perhaps five times a day, are participating in this. It's a sort of liturgical meditation, you may say. You're swept along on a sort of wave of sound, and you hardly need to meditate. You just let yourself go, you just participate, and perhaps you can say, well, there you are. So you're immersed in this. You're immersed in this wave of sound, or this ocean of sound, this ocean of vibrations, or this ocean of mantras, if you like, three and four and five times a day. And even if you may not be a very holy monk, and you may not be a very good geshe, and you may not know your logic and your vinaya very well, but it cannot fail, we may say, of its effect when you participate in this way, three and four and five times a day. Other times you may be doing anything. You may be chatting with your friends, or you may be studying in your cell, or you may be reading by yourself, or you may be splitting wood in the monastery kitchen, or you may be plying or reaping outside in the monastery fields, or you may be painting a picture, or you may be sawing a piece of wood, or you may be bringing great buckets of water up thousands of stone steps. It doesn't matter. When the trumpets sound, you drop everything and in you go. In you go, and you immerse yourself. So when you do this week after week, month after month, year after year, when you spend your life in this way, when you come to a point when you don't remember the day when you weren't a monk, then obviously it all sinks in, it all has its effect. So this is one of the ways in which the monks pass their time. Perhaps a third of their time in many monasteries is given over to the participation in these great liturgical services, which have a tremendous psychological and spiritual effect. And then what are they doing at other times? At other times, if they're studiously inclined, if they're intellectual, well, they study, they read the scriptures, they go to their teachers, they ask for explanations, they discuss among themselves, they practice the debate, the taksē, with all the ritual gestures, they practice meditation, they teach if they're qualified to teach. And many monks, of course, the less intellectual ones, they follow various professions, and they practice the arts and the crafts. Now, you may be interested to know that in Tibet, the doctors are mostly monks. This is one of the sciences, or one of the arts that they practice. And there is a special medical college, or was, in Lhasa, for training monk physicians. They follow, incidentally, a mixture of Indian and Chinese medical systems, and they practice, among other things, acupuncture. I don't know whether everybody knows about acupuncture, but it's carried on with a great silver needle, and punctures are made, that's why it's called acupuncture. Punctures are made in your skin at various points, corresponding to various nerve centers. And the flow of energy through those nerve centers is deflected, is changed. And energy in that way can be directed to one part of the body that needs it, or deflected from another part of the body or another organ which doesn't need so much energy, and so on. And I do know that the Tibetan practitioners of acupuncture, like their Chinese counterparts, it's a Chinese system, by the way, have effected quite a number of remarkable cures. And the Lama physicians, or monk physicians, also practice what we would call psychotherapy, or if you like, even faith healing. And sometimes this too is very effective. In addition to this, monks are also artists. Now, most of these beautiful tankas that you see, these painted scrolls, are painted by Tibetan monks. They're also carpenters. They make the monastic furniture. They make the tables and the desks and the stools, and so on. And they're tailors. They not only make the monk's robes, they make garments for lay people too. They ply the trade, as it were, of a tailor on the site. You can go and visit a monk in his cell and He'll sit there stitching, and he'll do you a coat or a pair of trousers, and, well, he earns a little money in that way on the side. That's the best, and see nothing wrong in it. It's part of life, they would say. And I remember that when I was in Kalimpong, the best ladies tailor there was a monk. And all the fashionable, all the aristocratic ladies of the locality used to swarm around this monk's quarters, asking for new bokus and new aprons and new whatever else it is that they wear. And the monk had a tremendous clientele and was very, very well known throughout the whole area as a lady's tailor. And again, the Tibetans see nothing wrong in this. He's just pursuing a craft, pursuing a trade, and helping to make both ends meet, as it were. And also, of course, monks are cooks. You've got this vast army of monks in the monasteries. They have to be fed and on the premises. So you've got monk cooks and monk chefs and monk kitchen boys and all the rest of it. And you've got monk cooks in chief who preside over perhaps 200 monastery cooks who are preparing breakfast, say, for 6,000 monks every morning and preparing lunch and so on. So it's quite a business. I remember, again, another little incident in Kalimpong when a new restaurant opened after the refugees came in. And everybody started going to that restaurant because the food was so good, Tibetan, Chinese, Indian, it was so good. So I made a few inquiries as to why this was, and I was told, well, among the refugees, there were some of the best cooks from Daepung Monastery, monks, of course, and they had taken on this restaurant and they were running it. And they were able in this way to provide for themselves, even though they were refugees. So these are some of the things that the monks do. They all participate, whatever their rank, whether they're abbots, whether they're great spiritual masters, teachers, or whether they are cooks and artists and carpenters, they all participate together every day, two or three or four times a day in these great services and chantings, and then they follow their various avocations. Some may teach, some may study, some may administer, some may be carpenters, cooks, drawers of water, hewers of wood, and so forth, all for the monastery. But all the monks, regardless of rank, they wear a dark maroon dress. A dark maroon, not only regardless of rank, but also regardless of school, except that the Nyingma Pas perhaps wear a slightly brighter and lighter shade than do the Gelugpas. And they incorporate also in their robes the three yellow robes of Indian tradition. But though they have these yellow robes, though they're given them when they're ordained, they usually keep them for ceremonial use only. They wear their red robes underneath, and on ceremonial occasions, when they're going to the hall for chanting, for instance, they put on the yellow robe over. But when they're going about on other occasions, the yellow robes are folded up and kept in a box, and they just go about in their ordinary red robes. Begging bowls, incidentally, which every monk has in the Theravada countries, in Tibet, for some reason or other, are very rare and are very highly prized.